This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss Israel's continued assault on Gaza and the West Bank, and the Trump administration doubling down, backing military aid to Israel while cracking down on pro-Palestinian voices at home.
Historian and Jewish Voice for Peace board member Barry Trachtenberg joins us to explore the dangerous implications for academic freedom, dissent, and the weaponization of anti-Semitism to silence solidarity.
Then we'll cover a growing movement. Labor unions, lawmakers, and community groups have joined forces to demand the removal of Elon Musk's so-called Doge from power.
We'll speak with Alex Sommerfeld, an anti-Zionist Jewish organizer and staff attorney with the American Federation of Government Employees. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. As Israel's expanding genocide of the Palestinian people in Gaza and the West Bank continues, with over 47,000 confirmed deaths and many times that unconfirmed, the Trump administration continues its unconditional military support of Israel while waging its own war at home against the movement for Palestinian rights. Trump has intensified his attacks by labeling pro-Palestinian protests as anti-Semitic and using that excuse to cancel student visas, deport pro-Palestinian activists, and revoke federal grants to major universities. To discuss the implications of all this on freedom of speech, academic freedom, and Trump's support of Israel, we're especially pleased today to be joined by Barry Trachtenberg. Professor Trachtenberg serves on the academic board of Jewish Voice for Peace and the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism. He holds the Rubin Presidential Chair of Jewish History at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. He is a historian of modern European and American Jewry and the author of three books on the Holocaust and the revolutionary roots of modern Yiddish. His writings on Zionism, anti-Semitism, and U.S. support for Israel have appeared in forums such as Jewish Currents, The Forward, Tablet, Electronic Intifada, Mandelweiss, and I'm going to garble this, Die Tanzzeitung, which is a German publication, obviously, A2 Alarm, which is Czech, and La Razón, which is Spanish. In 2017, he testified to the U.S. Congress on the topic of anti-Semitism on college and university classrooms. In January 2024, he testified in the lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights against the Biden White House, seeking an emergency order to stop military and diplomatic support for Israel's genocidal assault on Gaza. Barry, we're extremely grateful to have you. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
Barry, a great deal of public attention has been devoted to Project 2025, published by the Heritage Foundation, and how it has served as a blueprint for the catastrophic second Trump term. But much less attention's been paid to Project Esther, also published by the Heritage Foundation, which outlines a strategy for dismantling the Palestinian solidarity movement in the United States by deploying false claims of anti-Semitism and terrorism against the movement. And it lays out a sweeping program of surveillance, propaganda, deportation, and criminalization. Please take a few minutes to tell us about Project Esther, who wrote it, what it says, And then tell us about the comprehensive response to Project Esther, which you helped write on behalf of Jewish Voice for Peace Academic Council.
Thank you for that question. Project Esther was a report that was issued by the Heritage Foundation on October 7th, 2024, as a corollary to their larger Project 2025, which outlines the Trump administration's blueprint for the dismantling of many of the structures of the federal government, in particularly the protections that the federal government has created for marginalized and oppressed peoples, for environmental regulations, for protecting the health and welfare of the American population. Project Esther is called a national strategy to combat anti-Semitism, but it has actually very little to do with Jewish people, Jewish safety, or even anti-Semitism. Instead, it's an effort to dismantle the Palestine Solidarity Movement and to use those efforts as a wedge, really to take apart much of the progressive activism that occurs in the United States. As you may recall, the Heritage Foundation is an organization that began in the 1970s during the Nixon presidency. It really came to the fore during the Reagan administration, where it sought to inculcate extreme right-wing values and Christian evangelicism into American politics. And Project Esther reflects that in very significant ways. Although it was written on behalf of the Jewish people, ostensibly, it was not written by Jews. It was written by members of the Heritage Foundation, who are white Christian nationalists, with very little input from Jewish organizations. And it appropriates the story of Queen Esther, who's the hero of the Purim tale, the Jewish holiday of Purim, in which Jews escaped a genocide. It's a complicated story, but it really at its center is this strong feminist figure of Esther. What Project Esther seeks to do is to utilize the mechanisms of federal enforcement to go after Palestine Solidarity Movement, and has provided the blueprint for the Trump administration since coming into office in January. So it calls for attacking university programs, and it calls for attacking college student movements. It calls for the rounding up and the deportation of activists, and has very much provided the blueprint and the plan for the Trump administration. In response to this, a group from the Academic Council of Jewish Voice for Peace, of which I'm just one of many members, came together to write a response to this called Rejecting Project Esther and Christian Nationalism. And our report really tries to call out Project Esther for what it is, not for what it purports to be. Our project calls it out as really an attempt by Christian nationalists to dismantle the Palestine Solidarity Movement, to attack Jewish anti-Zionist organizing with groups such as Jewish Voice for Peace, and to really try to buttress support for the state of Israel, regardless of whatever actions it may take against its Palestinians.
Barry, Trump's executive orders have weaponized accusations of anti-Semitism, and I mean literally weaponized them, by conflating criticism of Israel's genocide in Gaza and the West Bank with virulent Jew hatred. Trump is canceling student visas, deporting pro-Palestinian activists, and revoking federal grants to universities such as Columbia and Harvard. What is going on here, and what do you find so dangerous about Trump's actions and how some of the universities are responding?
I'll say that much of Trump's policies are really following policies laid out by the Biden administration. Certainly, Trump's policies are more extreme. They're more violent. Mass arrests of Palestinian activists or people acting in solidarity with Palestinians. Just yesterday, you may have seen that at New York University's graduation, the valedictorian gave a speech on behalf of Palestinians and calling out the genocide, and now may not be able to graduate. They may have their diploma withheld by the university. At Harvard University, well over $2 billion of grants are at stake because Harvard refuses to capitulate fully the way that Columbia University has capitulated to the Trump administration's demands. We're seeing that new definitions of anti-Semitism, which are highly contested, are being enforced upon institutions as a condition for accepting federal aid. So we're in a very serious crisis moment where academic freedom is fully under attack by universities, including my own at Wake Forest. But it's really across the country where international students feel threatened and are no longer willing to come to the United States because, as we saw with, you know, at the case of Tufts University, a student was held for more than 6 weeks in a Louisiana prison simply for co-signing an op-ed to the local student newspaper calling for a boycott of Israel because of this genocide. So students are afraid, faculty are afraid. I think administrations don't really know how to respond. I think so many are capitulating rather than insisting upon their right to run their institutions independently. And it's really a crisis moment that we're in, where we're seeing the weaponization of anti-Semitism accusations really being used to try to dismantle the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And we should note that none of these efforts to go after quote-unquote anti-Semitism are really contending with anti-Semitism as it exists, because we know that the true threats to Jewish safety and security in the United States are not coming from Palestinian activists and their allies. They're coming from white supremacists, from the people who've been attacking Jews for centuries now, from Christian nationalists, from those people who feel that there is no place for Jews in society. It's what we saw at Charlottesville, at the Unite the Right rally, at the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh, with Elon Musk giving the Sieg Heil around the inauguration, from Steve Bannon, these other figures who believe that Jews are really have no place in Western society. But these reports, whether it's Project Esther, whether it's the Trump administration, they're not concerned with that because they are part of that project. So their concern for Jews really has nothing to do with Jews, unfortunately, except that it's putting all people at harm, including Jews.
Barry, I'd like you to contrast how Columbia has responded to these issues and Harvard. Earlier this month, two task forces at Harvard issued separate reports, one on anti-Semitism and the other on anti-Muslim, Arab, and Palestinian students. What did those reports get right, and what did they get wrong?
What we saw at Columbia University for much of the fall of 2023 and for, you know, quite a bit of 2024 was a strong protest movement against the Gaza genocide. There was a very large encampment that was put into place by students, many of whom identified as anti-Zionist Jews themselves, working in solidarity with Palestinians. It made a lot of news. The Columbia University responded in ways that were unprecedented in its history by allowing police to come onto campus to attack and arrest students. As you know, the president of the university was forced to resign. An interim president was put in their place. That interim president promised even a stronger crackdown on students. So then when the Trump administration, after coming into office, threatened to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars from Colombia unless they agreed to an incredibly draconian set of policy changes, to many people's dismay, but maybe not surprise, Colombia acquiesced. And so we're seeing that academic programs are being put into receivership. New definitions of anti-Semitism, which have often very little to do with actual anti-Semitism, are being put into place. There is more monitoring of the university. There's more repression on the student body. And Colombia did not protest. Colombia did not disagree with it, but sought to just negotiate the quickest way to get those funds back. Harvard, by contrast, has put up a little bit more of a fight. They have sought to take the Trump administration to court. That only followed a lawsuit by the faculty at Harvard University through the American Association of University Professors, the faculty union there, which was the first to initiate a lawsuit. But at Harvard, they're trying to walk a line where they are accepting many of the Trump administration's assumptions about the state of the campus, but simply disagree with the remedy. They don't want to be punished, and so they're putting up kind of a weak defense in the name of academic freedom. Complicating this were the two reports that came out earlier this month, or I think is actually very late April, where these two reports, which were some 500 pages in total, which were created separately, sought to reveal the extent to which there was Islamophobia at Harvard and anti-Semitism at Harvard. And the two reports are really quite different from one another. The report on Islamophobia, as I understand it, and I'll have to admit I haven't read all 500 pages of them, refers to the fact that something like 92% of the Muslim students and staff on campus believe they would face professional or academic penalties for expressing political views around Israel and Palestine. Muslim students reported living in enormous fear. They referred to the trucks that have been driving around campus, trucks displaying posters or digital signs that are doxing students, that are attacking members of the faculty of the university for, allegedly being anti-Semitic, for standing up on behalf of Palestinians. The major Jewish organizations on the campus have been attacking and criticizing students and faculty for their critiques of Israel. And it's a place where students who are Muslim and of Middle Eastern background experience real terror and fear. There's documented cases of students being attacked, spit on, being yelled at, being criticized in class, having their property vandalized for things such as wearing a keffiyeh or for attending a rally or a demonstration. The report on anti-Semitism is a bit different. Although it was the one that made all of the headlines, it actually concluded that the number of students who believe the campus is hostile to them was significantly lower. And rather than critiquing and really investigating the claims that were being put forward, they simply accepted all of the claims at face value. The report that came out conflated criticism with Israel with anti-Semitism, so it united the two. So, it sought to depict Harvard as a deeply anti-Semitic place. But because it refused to apply any criteria to the investigation itself, it simply accepted all of the arguments that were being generated. And so it painted a picture of Harvard as fundamentally anti-Semitic, and yet most of the instances that they refer to are about political disputes, where students who are claiming to be Zionist felt that the campus was inhospitable to them. But that's, of course, about a political difference, not about a religious identification. And so the report, I think, was done very, very poorly. It's been panned by many faculty at the university. But it will, of course, just add further fuel to the fire and lead to more attacks on the university and, I think, on academia as a whole.
Barry, you testified against the Biden administration in the case DCI Palestine v. Biden. Can you explain that litigation to our listeners, what role you played, and what the outcome was?
Yes. So in the fall of 2023, the Center for Constitutional Rights, working with other legal advocacy organizations, filed a lawsuit against the Biden White House, declaring it to be complicit with genocide. And helping to enable the genocide that was occurring, that is occurring in Gaza. And they sought to hold the White House accountable to the 1948 UN Convention on Genocide, which the United States ratified in 1998. When the United States ratified the convention, it exempted itself from being sued by other states. So what that means is, you know, as we saw, South Africa took Israel to international court. Well, the United States said when it ratified that treaty in 1988 that no other country could do that. So what that means is that only citizens could do that. And so what the Center for Constitutional Rights was able to do is it found seven Palestinian citizens living in the United States who had family back in Palestine who were under attack. And they worked with these different individuals and then different organizations such as Defense for Children International, that's the DCI, to bring a lawsuit to the courts. What the Biden White House argued was that citizens could not bring the White House to court over this issue, that this is a matter of foreign affairs, and that the courts have no jurisdiction, therefore. And so this was really at the root of the case. What was interesting, though, was that although the judge ultimately sided with the White House and said that, you know, to his regret, that the courts could not compel the White House to change its foreign policy, it showed deep sympathy for the plaintiffs in the case. And so really for the first time in history, Palestinians were provided a chance to speak about their experiences of living under Israeli rule. They could talk about what was happening to their families. And indeed, during one of the recesses that happened during the trial, one of the plaintiffs actually learned that yet another one of his family members had been murdered just in that brief period. Some of the plaintiffs talked about losing dozens and dozens of their family members during Israel's genocidal campaign. My role was to make the case to the courts that what was happening in Gaza at the time fit the UN definition of genocide. So I was given a chance to speak on that. And I also used my testimony as an opportunity to really make a plea to the judge that this court in particular had a very rare opportunity to change the course of history. And, you know, my training is in Jewish history and Holocaust studies, and I had recently published a book on the United States' its response to the Nazi Holocaust. And so I was thinking that, you know, so much of Holocaust studies in America and Holocaust memorial culture in the United States, such as the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., is really predicated on this belief that the United States failed to act when it had an opportunity to do so. And so I really sought to implore the judge that we are in a similar situation, although even worse in a way that the United States is not a bystander to the tragedy, such as was the case during the Holocaust, but is an active country that, you know, it's engaged in the violence itself. And that the judge had this very, very historically unique opportunity to put a hold to it. He was quite sympathetic to that, but unfortunately could not find a legal recourse that was available to him to allow that ruling. And so at the end, you know, he hadn't issued his ruling at the end of the day, but he really spoke of his deep sympathy for what the plaintiffs were enduring and wanted to convey to them that really for the first time in history, they would be seen and they would be heard by that court and their testimony would be taken down and available, you know, for the future.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. This is co-host Steve Rohde, and I'm joined today by Heidi Boghossian. Finally, Barry, with our time running out, what do you see as the future of progressive anti-Zionist Jews in America when it comes to the struggle for Palestinian rights?
This is, to me, a very clear answer, so I'll keep it short. The future of American Judaism will be anti-Zionist. What we see very, very clearly is there's a demographic shift that is occurring among younger American Jews who no longer believe that Zionism equals Judaism, that they must be bound by whatever Israel does. With the protest movements that have been occurring since October 2023, we see that groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, So Stand With Us, and so many others are really charting a path forward for a revitalized diasporic Judaism, which is no longer bound by Zionism.
Barry, thank you so much for what you've had to say today, for the insights you brought to us, and being a guest on Law and Disorder.
It's really my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity to talk through this. Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
A growing coalition of lawmakers, labor unions, and community advocates is rallying against what they call an illegal and anti-democratic takeover of the federal workforce. Members of the American Federation of Government Employees recently joined senators and representatives on the steps of the Office of Personnel Management in Washington. They demanded the removal of Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency, known as DOGE, from federal authority. Their message was clear. DOGE's dismantling merit-based civil service protections under the guise of, quote, efficiency, threatening thousands of federal workers in the process. The rally spotlighted the damage already done. More than 175,000 federal workers had been laid off or pressured into, quote, deferred resignation. Most of those affected, including more than 50,000 veterans, are victims of targeted purges that circumvent due process. Courts have already ruled against DOGE in more than 25 cases, though legal battles continue as DOGE seeks expanded access to agency data and systems. The AFGE and its allies argue that DOGE's agenda is not rooted in actual reform, but rather in political cronyism. Musk's directives include replacing experienced civil servants with political loyalists and eliminating oversight roles like inspectors general. AFGE President Everett Kelly called DOGE a symptom of, quote, blatant disdain for the federal workforce in his four decades of union service.
Today's guest, Alex Summerfield, is a Jewish anti-Zionist organizer with People's Power Assembly in Baltimore. For the past 3 years, Alec has worked as a staff attorney for the American Federation of Government Employees. He also serves as a shop steward in the Office of Professional Employees International Union. Alec, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Alec, can you explain how DOJ's workforce reductions have affected essential government services and what the broader implications are for public welfare?
Absolutely. So it's a great question, and it's something that at AFG, at the National VA Council, and really just as a progressive person involved in progressive organizations overall, that we're all having to sort of navigate, particularly here at AFGE, though. And to just start concretely, the biggest thing here for me is that these DOJ attacks are attacks on the people, right? The frontline workers who actually do the work. This is an attempt to make it impossible for those people, the people who work in Social Security and Medicaid and work for the VA, really all the parts of the government that aren't defense. These DOJ attacks want to not just reduce the amount of people doing those jobs and bringing those services to people, but they want to make it as difficult as possible for the people who are doing the jobs to get it done at all. And they do that by scaling back union rights, attacking the union contracts, making it harder for people to get representation, making it easier to just pile assignments on people. And really, it's an effort directed to make it impossible for the people who are left to do their jobs if their jobs are in agencies outside defense. They really want to bring that to a halt. And so they are going after the people who make these agencies work. They are going to make it as difficult as possible for people to do their jobs, and they're going to make it so these government agencies do their jobs with as few employees as possible. They want to pay as few people as possible. They want to give out benefits to as few people as possible. And they want to bring what's left of social benefits in this country to a total and complete stop. That's what they want. And here's the thing in this country, you know, it's not like these benefits like Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security were really enough to begin with. You know, I think a lot of us in the movement have fought to try and make these benefits real and substantial. And so because they're not strong enough. And now we see DOJ just trying to destroy all of them, try to take what's left from the New Deal and from the Great Society programs of the 60s and say, we're not doing that anymore. No more unions, no more civil rights, no more Medicare, no more Medicaid, no more Social Security is an attempt to totally break working people. And the breaking of working people is never good for public welfare. That's how I view it.
So, Alec, it seems like the Trump administration and DOJ think they've hit upon a way to destroy everything you've described without going to Congress, without addressing the merits of these programs. They're just going to starve these programs by withdrawing funds. So dig deeper, if you can. What's the scope of this in terms of how many federal workers have been either fired or suspended? Particularly veterans and longtime public servants. And would you comment on what kind of a threat this poses to the civil service protections that have been longstanding for federal workers?
You know, there are a couple aspects to this. So first, there's the obvious thing of tens of thousands of people, some probationary, some longtime federal workers have already been laid off. Probably, actually, at this point, probably well over 100,000 because HHS has already implemented huge layoffs. USDA has implemented huge layoffs. DOD has implemented huge layoffs. Now, the VA is trying to implement these layoffs, but for a variety of reasons, they've been held up. A lot of that having to do with the VA Council of AFG being really the strongest council in AFGE and being a bit of a fortress inside VA for working people. So they haven't been able to do that yet. But when they do, and it'll be interesting to see how they try to get around seniority, because the target of these RIFs is experienced people who have been working for the federal government for a long time. They have good salaries. They have strong benefits. They have a lot invested in retirement. and they're career people who are, you know, generally dedicated to their craft. And I think this administration wants to just totally wipe that out. So what makes things really difficult is, on top of it already being difficult to have layoffs and everything, is that there's some stop and start happening because of various legal cases. An example is the probationary employees. You know, one of the first things they did when they took power is they laid off like almost every probationary employee in the federal government. Court said, a district court said, you can't do that. So then they started rehiring probationary people. But then a circuit court, and now the Office of the Special Counsel is saying, oh, no, you can fire them at will, essentially. And so now you've got this terrible where you've got people who were fired, then briefly back at work, and now fired again. And not only does that cause an incredible amount of stress on the actual people who are having to go through that, it brings a certain level of dysfunction. And I think, you know, what Steve said about, you know, choking this stuff off, they realize that maybe the statutes or the Constitution is too strong to fundamentally undermine these, but they will make it impossible for these things to work. And when you have people, new employees, especially probation employees, coming in and out of the workforce like that, it creates an intense level of dysfunction. And the same can be said for layoffs of full employees too, because you've got people, even if we have legal victories, and we are having some, you've got people coming in and out, you don't have continuity of assignment, you don't have continuity of agenda, and it brings everything to a terrible grinding halt. So when we ask, how does Elon Musk's vision pose a threat to civil service protections? I think it poses a threat to the civil service, period, as we understand it. I think this is existential. I really do, because I think the ultimate goal of all this stuff is to lead to a giant pivot to contracting out and to privatization. You know, can't protect the civil service, can't have merit protections and benefits and other things like that in career appointments if you don't have a civil service. And I really think this is intended on giving a boon to private healthcare providers, to private insurance providers. I think they even want to privatize national parks. So, I mean, I really think this is existential for the civil service. And I think they felt like that with all this money they've been paying federal employees all this time, they've left money on the table that could have gone to their buddies in the private sector. And now this is trying to really do away with the civil service and what made it so attractive for workers looking for jobs and careers. Really, I think Musk's vision is not to have a civil service and just to have a bunch of different contractors giving bare minimum services. And if services at all, and the reason I say that is because we've already kind of seen it on the state level. I remember back during the height of the pandemic in Maryland specifically, I live in Baltimore, the Maryland Unemployment Division contracted out its system to a private company. And what ended up happening to that was just total disaster. The services essentially stopped. And I really think that's sort of the goal for really a lot of the federal government that's outside defense. I think they want contractors who will pay people in the private sector minimum, and the services will be non-existent. So I really do think this Musk-Trump era is existential for the civil service.
Alec, can you discuss the deferred resignation strategy? What is it, and why is it so concerning to unions and labor advocates?
Yeah. This deferred resignation program, at least for me, it is no less than evil. And there have been a couple of rounds of it. You know, they've tried this two or three times. So the idea is that the federal government, Musk, Doge, whoever, you know, they send out a letter, an email to the federal worker, whatever federal worker it is, and they say, hey, if you want, we'll pay you admin leave. You know, we'll put you on administrative leave. You won't be working, and we'll pay you until, you know, you resign, retire, whatever, in 6 months, September, October, you know, whenever. So it's, if you go on admin leave now, we'll pay you till then, and then you can go. You know, at first, a lot of people were resisting it, but as this has worn on and they extended who they were offering this deferred resignation program to, because at first it was a more limited group of employees, but they really opened it up. But this last time, like before, they hadn't included nurses at the VA, right, which is a huge number of people. Now those people are included. It's really tough for the person who's being offered it because at first it appears like, oh, well, this is great. You know, I'll get paid and I won't have to do anything. And then, you know, I'll resign and it'll be fine. It's super concerning to unions for several reasons. The first is, and this isn't necessarily the biggest, but one of the big things is that DOGE didn't talk to any unions about this. They bypassed all the unions and they went directly to the employee. And so we didn't have the chance to give perspective or context to this to be like, this is really a trap. Because here's the thing, it is a trap. And so this wasn't discussed with any unions. They're just putting this stuff out there, going directly to the worker, which violates the federal sector labor management relations statutes, and because bypass is an unfair labor practice, meaning that the management can't deal directly with the employee without including the employee's representative. So that was a problem. The second problem, really the bigger one, is what I mentioned before, is that it's a trap. We're already hearing that DOGE and the government are going to back out paying the administrative leave, and that they're not going to pay people, and that they're just going to have people on AWOL. So that's something we're already hearing, because no agreements were ever really made on a large scale, like outside of individual agreements that said, hey, you have to pay these people, and if you don't, here are the consequences. And some of the individual agreements people signed for this deferred resignation program, the agency or DOGE has already come back and said, we're changing it unilaterally, and it's going to be different now. So the whole thing was a trap to try and get people to quit without having to go through union negotiated RIF layoff procedures and have to pay out and go by seniority and all those things. So it's really another attempt to circumvent labor protections and to try and get people to quit, and then they lose potential benefits that they might have if they are laid off, or if they're laid off under the layoff procedures of a contract, or if the agency tries to find a way to discipline them, then that's a whole fight. It's a really sneaky, evil way of sort of taking advantage of the fact that I think federal workers are tired, they're feeling besieged, it's a tough economy. At first glance, this idea of, oh, I can just hang out and get paid till I resign, I get why it would be really attractive to people. But the fact is that with these things, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. And that this is really just another attempt to undermine labor protections, to trick workers into doing things that are against their own interest. And the problem is ultimately now, these are all people who are now going into the labor market. The labor market's totally flooded. So it's super concerning for us, for unions on both those levels, because not only is it an unfair labor practice in terms of how they did it, because they didn't deal with unions at all, but the bigger thing, the bigger level thing is that they're trying to screw workers out of union protections, and they're trying to get workers to do it to themselves. They're essentially they're using bait to try and get workers to act against their own interest. And that is wildly concerning for us.
So your union your organization is fighting back. The American Federation of Government Employees has filed legal actions. Tell us about the types of lawsuits that your group has brought. You've had some success in the courts. What are the judges saying?
Great question. So a couple of things. So in terms of what you might call litigation, we've had sort of a two-pronged strategy. So there have been the lawsuits in federal district court, the one against DOGE for their reorganization and reduction in force plan. And the other major AFG case in district court is around Donald Trump's order saying that a bunch of different agencies are excluded from federal labor protections because they involve quote-unquote national security. So there are those two lawsuits that are sort of the big ones, and I'll talk about them in a minute, especially the DOGE layoff one, because there's some good news with that. On the other side, in my work directly, we have filed a bunch of national grievances. It's contractual. It's a contractual grievance process. But the idea is that we've run into some issues with what's called the channeling doctrine. And so it's why we're trying to keep this on both roads, these fights on both roads, because some of the stuff that I personally have filed grievances against DOGE for is somewhat similar of an issue to what's being fought out in the district courts to some extent. And why I mentioned channeling is because the idea with channeling is that if a union tries to challenge an executive order or a change in government-wide rule in the federal district court, there has been this doctrine that says, oh, no, you have to go through and either file a UOP or a grievance and then take it through the appellate process of the Federal Labor Relations Authority. And that's made things really difficult for the union, especially when now the government is trying to make it so these contracts don't even exist. He's saying these contracts don't apply because national security is involved. So you're saying, okay, we have to channel, we have to go through our administrative process, but you're also trying to take away the administrative process. So it's definitely created a bit of a catch-22 there, but we're continuing with the in-court litigation and the arbitrations to try and, you know, keep this on two paths in case we run into the channeling doctrine. Now, in terms of Doe's and lawsuit against Doe's, the really good news was that the judge granted a temporary restraining order against Doe's. And this was AFT's lawsuits. I know the lawyers who filed the suit. And the judge said that the reorg itself and all these layoffs that Doe's wants to implement through this government reorganization, the judge found that the union was likely to win on the merits regarding the fact that not only is it unconstitutional because it actually violates the First Amendment, but that's for another thing. The bigger problem with the reorg is that it violates the federal sector labor management relations statute. And because that all creates a framework for how labor is supposed to be worked with in the federal sector, the protections people have, all these things. And so Doge's reorg and these mass layoffs, not only do they violate the contracts they have with unions, but they violate that statute because there's all sorts of things you're supposed to do that they're not doing. And because of that, the judge found that AFGE was likely to win on the merits. So the judge granted a temporary restraining order on that Doge reorg slash layoff plan. Now, the temporary restraining order is only for 2 weeks, but it bodes well, I think, for getting a preliminary injunction. If we can get an injunction on these Doge layoffs and this Doge reorg, it at least gives the union some time to try and continue to plan, get organized, figure out how to fight back. Because sort of, while it's great to get these victories, and we're hoping to have news on the temporary restraining order for the collective bargaining case soon, there's still sort of the dark cloud of the Supreme Court hanging over all of this. And the general thought is, unfortunately, that even if we get these early wins, it could end up in the Supreme Court and they'll cover for President Trump anyway. But, you know, we still have to continue to fight. And these victories at the district court level and in arbitration, they bite us time. They bite us time. They give us time to try to get organized, to figure out other ways to fight back, to mobilize. Because, well, you know, while I believe we do have to fight this in the courts, fighting things in the courts can also be limited, especially with the current composition of the Supreme Court. And also a lot of the circuit benches are not super friendly to labor. So it's a difficult field, but we're fighting anyway. And we are getting wins because what Doge has done flies so in the face of even the weak protections that we have for labor and for the federal sector and labor management relations. These are weak protections that exist, but they are protections. Doge's actions just totally, in the plain language, fly in the face of those protections.
Alec, in terms of the fight back, can you describe methods that federal employees and unions are using outside of the courtroom? And also, what is the significance of elected officials speaking out recently at a rally?
You know, the one thing I think has been very good is we're starting to see unions really take to the streets. And, you know, there have been a couple of big demonstrations. There was the Hands Off Our Benefits stuff. I believe that was in late April. There was a national call for demonstrations that unions really got involved in. There was a big march in D.C. that AFGE and SEIU and all the big unions were involved in. But what really stood out to me this year, before I go to that, other thing I want to say is that there are legislative political organizers here at AFGE who have been holding rallies all across the country outside of different government facilities, VA facilities, DOD facilities, about all this stuff. So people are really starting to get into the streets. The locals are realizing that they can't just sit and wait for the court So they've been having rallies, demonstrations, picket lines, petitions, a lot of stuff in social media. So really, any way we can fight back, we are. What really encouraged me, though, is that the unions, at least for the first time since I've been really involved, got involved with May Day. And I was really encouraged to see that, because usually, for a lot of reasons, May Day is usually left to sort of the more radical left organizations to do it, to get together. And this year in Baltimore, and for the first time at a Baltimore May Day, I walked in the union contingent, which was almost 1,000 people. The way the Baltimore May Day happened, it was sort of a bunch of feeder marches and then one big one. And it was really cool to see that it was the union demonstration that really brought the muscle to the whole event. And to see that, I mean, people from AFGE, people from SEIU, people from the metal trades, different craft unions, IBEW, the machinists. I mean, everybody was there. Everybody had really strong messaging and really strong contingents. And to see that at a May Day was really great for me. You know, I'm a little younger, and May Day, you know, while it's a union holiday at a lot of places across the world, it has less so been that here. But to see that, it's like, you know, people are awake. People know what's happening. It's interesting. At that event, there weren't any elected officials. I am glad to see people speaking out. Ultimately, for me, I think the power comes from the people. We're getting towards the end, but, you know, I want to mention that, you know, the Palestine issue is also very near and dear to my heart as a Jewish person. And so it's tough for me to see some of these same officials who were frankly silent, if not supportive, of the genocide in Gaza. I'm glad they're speaking out now. I'm glad that, you know, they're standing up against Trump. But ultimately, I think the power comes from the people and from organized labor. And if we're going to beat this stuff back, we're going to have to be in the streets and make it clear that, this is unacceptable.
As we turn to the question of Palestinian sovereignty and your work on that, have you found common ground between labor unions and pro-Palestinian organizations? How have these alliances influenced your work?
I think those alliances are starting to form. I mentioned the May Day demonstration in Baltimore, and I was really moved. There were several different union speakers who explicitly brought up Palestine. And where I think the connection here is, if we had all the money being sent overseas, wherever it may be, for this example, to Israel, and they wage war on Gaza, West Bank, and different countries in that region, all that money being sent can be invested into our federal employees and the services that they provide. And I think that's really where the connection is. And while these two movements have been kind of separate, I think they're starting to converge. The impetus, the justification by Musk and Trump for all these cuts to the federal sector is, oh, it's so expensive, we're spending so much money, it's a boondoggle, all these things. Yet you have no problem, you know, with a $1 trillion defense budget and billions going into bombs that kill children. So you need money, right? You say that we need money to pay for social benefits and for social welfare and for civil servants and for a strong federal government that provides services. Okay, fine. I can tell you where you can get all the money. It's all that money you're sending to wage war on the world and to wage war on Palestine. All that money to missiles and to the military and to huge aircraft carriers in the Red Sea that launch fighters that bomb Yemen. What, the U.S. lost two jets that fell off aircraft carriers, and they're each like $50 million jets. We were talking about a lot of money. And if that money was back on our shores, we could reinvest it in our workers. We can invest it in Medicare, Medicaid, real universal health care in this country. I mean, all that money, there is so much we could fix the train system in this country, rail system. But really, all that money could come back and be invested in good federal jobs to provide services. And that's exactly what they don't want. They want it invested in war. They want the boon to Boeing and Northrop Grumman and all these big defense corporations. They don't want it invested back in the workforce, because that empowers the workforce, and they do not want that. They want the opposite. So for me, that's how those two struggles connect. There's a lot of money being sent overseas that could be reinvested into good federal jobs that provide the services that the workers of this country need.
Well, that was very well said. Alec, how can our listeners follow your work, and what are a few things they could do to support federal workers and, in general, broader democratic integrity?
Yes, just very briefly, the two organizations, I would encourage people to look into the Baltimore People's Power Assembly and the Harriet Tubman Center for Social Justice in Los Angeles. Those are sort of sister community organizations who do a lot of work supporting unions and do a lot of work around issues of police brutality, anti-imperialism, anti-war, stuff like that. In terms of supporting federal workers, the one thing I really want to plug people, if people just, you know, Google AFGE private donation, AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees, we set up a Federal Employee Defense Fund. And if you just Google that, that'll come right up and you can donate. And that's really appreciated because, you know, a lot of we lost a lot of our dues money. So that would be great. Keep looking out for actions in your area from the hands-off movement and the different unions and get out there in the streets.
Alec, thank you so much for your work and for joining us on Law and Disorder. We hope to stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.